Bishop of Rome sent several churchmen to be his representatives, along with his own written statement detailing the exact relationship of the two natures. In Leo's view, the council could be a short one. His delegates should read his statement, and then, Peter having spoken, no further discussion should be allowed or required. But under Marcion's direction, the bishops instead agreed that the statement was in line with what they had already decided on their own authority. They also agreed, again prompted by Marcion, that the Bishop of Constantinople, while perhaps second to the Bishop of Rome himself, nevertheless had more authority than any other bishop. He was not merely a bishop, but a patriarch, a churchman with authority over other bishops. This produced a series of letters between Leo, Marcion, and the Eastern bishops, in which Leo complained that the East wasn't paying enough attention to his authority, and Marcion and the bishops told Leo to mind his own business, with all of this jockeying for position framed in flowery sacred language. "The See of Constantinople shall take precedence," the bishops wrote to Leo. "We are persuaded that, with your usual care for others, you have extended that apostolic prestige, which belongs to you, to the church in Constantinople, by virtue of your great disinterestedness in sharing all your own good things with your spiritual kinsfolk. But your Holiness's delegates attempted vehemently to resist this decision. I am surprised and grieved that the peace of the universal church, which had been divinely restored, is again being disturbed by a spirit of self-seeking," Leo wrote back to Marcion. "Let the city of Constantinople have its high rank and long enjoy your rule, but secular things stand on a different basis from things divine. Anatolius, the bishop of Constantinople, cannot make it an apostolic see." Hedging his bets, he also wrote to Pulcheria, the emperor's wife, "Anatolius has been inflamed with undue desires and intemperate self-seeking," he complained. "By the blessed apostle Peter's authority, we do not recognize the bishop's assent to Constantinople's exaltation." And to the bishop of Constantinople himself, Leo wrote, "You went so far beyond yourself as to drag in an occasion of self-seeking. This haughty arrogance tends to the disturbance of the whole church." None of this was as bloody as the battles going on in Gaul between Aetius's army and the Huns, but the issue was not all that different. It was an argument over territory, over authority, over legitimacy. A battle for a spiritual crown, but a crown nonetheless. Leo's protests got him nowhere. The emperor continued to insist on the prestige and independence of the Bishop of Constantinople, and the Council of Chalcedon closed on that note. The Eastern Roman Empire had taken an additional step away from Rome. The after-effects of the council would ripple on through the Eastern Kingdom for years to come. Down in Egypt, resentment ran strong over the demotion of the Bishop of Alexandria to a place below the Bishop of Constantinople. The resentment continued in a strong underground current that would only grow more destructive. And now that the Council of Chalcedon had confirmed, as orthodoxy, that Christ's two natures were separate but indivisible, many Christians who disagreed with this formulation began to migrate over into Persia, where they were welcomed by the Persian Emperor Yazdegerd II, son of Bahram V, who had died in 438. Author's note, the same term was later used of Vatican II by some Catholics. Despite his willingness to disaccommodate Marcion by accepting his refugees, Yazdegerd II was no friend of Christianity. In fact, he had not long before imposed his own sort of orthodoxy. Rather than doing this through council, as Marcion had, Yazdegerd simply decreed that Zoroastrianism would be followed in all parts of his empire, including the Persian half of Armenia, which up until this point had remained Christian. The decree is recorded by the Christian Armenian historian Yegishe, who heard it with his own ears. "He alleged that we, the believers in Christ, were his opponents and enemies," Yegishe writes, "and commanded, 'All peoples and tongues throughout my dominions shall abandon their false religions and shall come to worship the Son.'" Like Marcion, Yazdegerd II had both political and theological motivations. He was devout in his faith, but the decree was motivated more by a desire to root out any sympathy with the Eastern Romans, particularly in the less reliably loyal parts of his empire. The Armenians saw the decree both as an abridgment of their freedoms, which it was, and as religious persecution, and refused to give up their Christian faith. Many of the Christians who went to Persia were Nestorians, who believed that the Council of Chalcedon had not made enough distinction between Christ's two natures. Ultimately, the difference in doctrine would split the Christians of Persia decisively away from both Rome and Constantinople. The branch of Nestorian Christianity thus formed would be known as the Syrian Orthodox Church. Yazdegerd reacted with force. In 451, the same year as the Council of Chalcedon, he marched into Armenia. 66,000 Armenians gathered behind their great general Vartan, ready to go into battle as martyrs. In the fight that followed, the Battle of Vartanants, Vartan was killed, and both sides suffered heavy losses. Consciousness of defeat came to both sides, Yegishe says, because the piles of the fallen bodies were so thick that they looked like craggy masses of stone. Ultimately, the Persians were victorious over the smaller Armenian army. Yazdegerd II imprisoned and tortured the surviving leaders and reduced Armenia to a Persian territory, putting a new governor in charge of the country. Meanwhile, Yazdegerd II took preventative measures against other possible dissidents. In 454, he began to enact a series of decrees that kept the Jews in Persia from observing the Sabbath, and eventually from educating their children in Jewish schools. Both emperors were still operating under the belief that one set of religious beliefs would make their empire stronger, that orthodoxy, the enforcement of a single theology and religious practice, would bind the territory together. But in both Persia and the Eastern Empire, the discontent was merely driven out of sight, where it spread beneath the surface like groundwater. Chapter 19. The High Kings. Between 451 and 470, Ireland falls under the domination of the Unil. Patrick brings Christianity to the island, and Vortigern invites the Angles and the Saxons to Britain. Past the battlefields of Gaul, across the water from the growing power of the Visigoths in Hispania, far away from the Western throne, the islands of Britain were piecing together their own identity. The western island of Ireland, never occupied by Roman soldiers or crisscrossed with Roman roads, was taking its own winding path towards nationhood. Like the tribes that surrounded the Roman Empire, the peoples of Ireland were a collection of tribes and clans, each boasting a certain local power and led by a warlord and his family. But even without Roman conquest, the Irish tribes were not free from Roman influence. In 451, the strongest tribe in Ireland was the Vanii, or Fenai, and the strongest clan of the Fenai was the Connachta. The leader of the Connachta family was named Niall of the Nine Hostages, and his mother was Roman. Niall's father, Yochi, had captured a Roman girl during a raid on Britannia and made her his concubine. Niall, the youngest son in his family, became clan leader after his father's death. The chronicles of Irish history, most of which come from centuries later, weave his exploits into legend and combine them with the accomplishments of other Irish kings, making it difficult to sift out exactly what Niall had accomplished. But one of the tales hints at a very bloody rise to power. According to The Adventures of the Sons of Yochi Mugmadun, Yochi sends Niall and his four older brothers, all sons of his father's legitimate wife, unlike Niall, on a quest to determine which of them deserved to inherit his power. On their journey, the sons grow thirsty and go in search of water. They found a well, but a horrible hag guarded it. Every joint and limb of her, from the top of her head to the earth, was as black as coal. Like the tail of a wild horse was the grey, bristly mane that came through the upper part of her head crown. The green branch of an oak, in bearing, would be severed by the sickle of green teeth that lay in her head and reached to her ears. Dark, smoky eyes she had, a nose crooked and hollow. She had a middle fibrous, spotted with pustules, diseased, and shins distorted and awry. Her ankles were thick, her shoulder blades were broad, her knees were big, and her nails were green. The hag demands that the brothers trade sex for access to the well. The four older brothers refuse, but Niall throws himself enthusiastically on her, ready to sleep with her for the sake of the water. Immediately she transforms into a beautiful maiden in a royal purple cloak. "I am the sovereignty of Erin," she tells him, "and as you have seen me loathsome, bestial, horrible at first, and beautiful at last, so is the sovereignty, for seldom it is gained without battles and conflicts, but at last to anyone it is beautiful and goodly." In the tale, Niall's brothers then acclaim him as family leader of their own free will. But Niall's rise, first to power over his clan, and then to the kingship of the Fenai tribe, was undoubtedly accompanied with violence, forced possession, and bloodshed, bestial and horrible. Only with the crown in one hand and his sword in the other could he claim the beauty of legitimate kingship. Over the decades of his reign, Neil expanded his power over the Fenai into one of the first exercises of high kingship, control over the other minor kings of Ireland, over the other tribes. He earned the nickname Neil of the Nine Hostages by taking prisoners from nine of the tribes that lay around him, guaranteeing the loyalty of their tribal leaders. With Ireland more or less united under his rule, he then launched raids on the coasts of Gaul and Britain. During one of these raids, he captured a Romanized Briton named Patricius and took him back to Ireland as a slave, where Patricius served for 6 years, before stowing away on an Irish raiding ship and escaping into Gaul when it docked. There, he was converted to Christianity and had a vision calling him to return to the land of his slavery and teach the Irish of Christ. This much we learn from Patricius's own writings, his Confessio. By the time he arrived back at the High King's court, Neil of the Nine Hostages had died in battle, either in Britain or in Gaul, and his own sons were battling over his kingdom. While interfamily warfare went on around him, Patricius devoted himself to the spread of Christianity, so successfully that Ireland became Christian long before the British island to the east. Later Christian historians knew him as St. Patrick, the apostle to the Irish, and credited him with driving the snakes out of Ireland. In fact, there had been no snakes in Ireland since the end of the Ice Age. No reptile is found there, writes the English church historian Bede, for although serpents have often been brought from Britain, as soon as the ship approaches land they are affected by the scent of the air and quickly perish. But for the Christian writer, a snake was much more than a snake. Satan had taken the shape of a snake in the Garden of Eden, and serpents, which were sacred to the Druids, the practitioners of the indigenous religion of Ireland, symbolized the powers of darkness that were opposed to the gospel of Christ. The new faith was slowly supplanting the old. By the time of Patricius's death, sometime before 493, three sons of Neil held power over three kingdoms in the northern half of the island: Mee, where the ancient city of Tara lay, Uleg, and Connachta, the original homeland of the clan. Their descendants would rule as the Aeneal dynasty for 600 years, but their influence would stretch far, far beyond the Middle Ages. Neil's particular Y chromosome shows up in as many as 3 million men worldwide. His sons and their Randy offspring managed to sire so many children that 1 in 12 Irishmen, 1 in 5 in the part of Ireland that was once Connachta, can claim Neil of the Nine Hostages as their ancestor. Despite their dominance, the Aeneal did not conquer the whole island. In the southwest of Ireland, the clan of the Oonach still ruled, resisting the spread of Fenai power. To the southeast, the Lane tribe held on to its land as well. But some of the Lane left, in the face of ongoing attacks from Neil's descendants, and settled on the northern coast of Britain, in the area that became Wales. There, in flight from the High King of Ireland, they came into direct conflict with the High King of Britain. This High King was, so far as we can tell, a man named Vortigern, who by 455 had the unenviable task of defending Britain from invaders determined to take the island for their own. Roman Britain, more or less abandoned by its occupiers after the departure of Constantine III in 410, was now a collection of local warlords, mostly Romanized Celt or Celticized Roman, along with a few Saxon settlements which the Romans had allowed along the coast. Raids from Irish pirates, the Scoti, had grown more vicious under the dominance of the Aeneal. In the vivid words of the 6th century historian Gildas, the Irish raiders emerged from their ships like dark throngs of worms who wriggle out of narrow fissures in the rock when the sun is high and the weather grows warm. The northern Picts, meanwhile, were launching ever more vicious attacks down across Hadrian's Wall, aiming to grab the north of England for their own. In the face of all this chaos, the minor kings and tribal chiefs of Britain gathered together in council, in which they elected the northern King Vortigern as their war leader. Vortigern sent one of those chiefs, a British warlord named Cuneda, to drive the Lane out of their new home. Cuneda, his 8 sons, and his soldiers did so, and founded a kingdom of their own, Gwynedd, in the conquered land. Vortigern also sent a letter to the Roman Magister Militum Aetius, begging for help against the Picts, but it went unanswered. In desperation, Vortigern suggested that the remaining British soldiers bolster their ranks with Saxon allies. The British could allow more Saxon settlements in the south, particularly in Essex and in Kent on the southeastern coast, in exchange for tribute warriors who would help them to fight against the Picts and the Irish. The other chiefs agreed, and so Vortigern sent messages not only to the Saxons on the distant North Sea coast just west of modern Denmark, but also to their allies the Angles, who lived just northeast of the Saxons on the dividing line between modern Germany and Denmark. This strategy, undertaken in desperation, earned him the hatred of later historians. "They devised for our land," froths Gildas, "that the ferocious Saxons, name not to be spoken, hated by man and god, should be let into the island like wolves into the fold, to beat back the peoples of the north." How utter the blindness of their minds, how desperate and crass the stupidity. But at first the strategy seemed to be working. The Angles and the Saxons accepted the invitation, and around 445 they sailed across the water to join the British in their fight against the Picts. "They fought against the enemy who attacked from the north," Bede writes, "and the Saxons won the victory. In return, Vortigern granted the allies settlement rights in Kent." Or, as the inexorably hostile Gildas puts it, "the newcomers fixed their dreadful claws on the east side of the island, ostensibly to fight for our country, in fact, to fight against it." The Saxons and Angles, once established in the green land of Kent, did not stay nicely in the granted land. They had ambitions to spread farther. In a matter of months, new shiploads of their countrymen, along with the Jutes, allies of the Angles who lived on the Danish peninsula just north of them, were arriving on the southeastern shores in longships. They were full of armed warriors, the British historian Geoffrey of Monmouth says, men of huge stature. Vortigern had crushed the northern menace, and in doing so had created a southern invasion. Led by two Saxon brothers named Hengest and Horsa, the Jutes occupied the southern coast. The Saxons moved from Kent, farther inland, to the south and southwest of Londinium, and the Angles invaded the southeastern coast just above the Thames. Destruction reigned. All the major towns were laid low, Gildas mourns. In the middle of the squares, the foundation stones of high walls and towns that had been torn from their lofty base, holy altars, fragments of corpses, covered, as it were, with a purple crust of congealed blood, looked as though they had been mixed up in some general wine press. There was no burial to be had except in the ruins of houses or the bellies of beasts and birds. The British tribes, allied behind Vortigern, spent 6 years fighting fruitlessly against the overwhelming influx. The invaders seemed unstoppable, so fierce that the monk Nennius, writing his History of the Britons several centuries later, ascribes magical malice to them. Vortigern, he insists, was unable to build a fortress that would withstand them until his court magicians told him that he would need to find a child born without a father, sacrifice him, and sprinkle his blood over the foundations. This echo of a druidic ritual suggests that the British were driven to drastic and ancient strategies in desperate defense of their country. But Nennius, a Christian priest constructing a Christian history, adds that the sacrifice never actually happened. Instead, the child, once discovered, showed Vortigern a pool beneath his proposed foundations in which two serpents, one white and one red, slept. "The red serpent is your dragon," he told Vortigern, "but the white serpent is the dragon of the people who occupy Britain from sea to sea. At length, however, our people shall rise and drive away the Saxon race from beyond the sea." This after-the-fact prophecy was not entirely fulfilled. In 455, Vortigern finally managed to defeat the invaders in a pitched battle at the fords of the Medway River in Kent. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle says that Horsa was killed in the fighting. The loss of one of their chiefs forced the invaders to regroup, and for a few brief moments, Vortigern must have had wild hopes of victory. But Horsa's son took up his father's mantle, and the balance tipped back. For the next 15 years, war continued, each year seeing a new and violent conflict between Vortigern, his men, and the newcomers, neither side gaining the advantage, neither willing to come to terms. Chapter 20. The End of the Roman Myth. Between 454 and 476, the Vandals sack Rome, and the last emperor leaves Ravenna. Aetius had not answered Vortigern's plea for help, because he had troubles of his own. Sentiments against his domination of the Western Empire had been growing, and the Hun invasion of Italy had given him a black eye. He had powerful enemies at court, most notably Petronius Maximus, a Roman senator who had been prefect of Rome twice. In 454, Aetius made a final misstep when he arranged the engagement of his son to Valentinian III's daughter. It was a clear attempt to put his family in line for the Western throne. Valentinian III, still only 36, had been emperor of Rome for 30 years, but had always ruled in the shadow of his general. He had lost much of his empire. Hispania and much of Gaul were gone to the Suevi and the Visigoths, and North Africa to the Vandals, who, under their great king Gaiseric, had already taken Sicily and were eyeing Italy itself. Huns had stormed through Italy almost without check, and the Bishop of Rome had done Valentinian's job while he cowered. It was easy for Petronius Maximus to convince the emperor to focus his discontent on Aetius. "The affairs of the Western Romans were in confusion," writes the historian John of Antioch, "and Maximus persuaded the emperor that unless he quickly slew Aetius, he would be slain by him." In 455, Valentinian III was in Ravenna when Aetius came to court on a routine visit to discuss tax collection. He was standing in front of Valentinian III, absorbed in presenting the difficulties of raising money, when Valentinian III leaped up from his seat, shouting that he would no longer put up with treachery, and swung his sword against Aetius's head. The great general died on the floor of the throne room while the stunned courtiers watched. John of Antioch says that Valentinian then turned in satisfaction to one of his officers and said, "Was not the death of Aetius well accomplished?" The officer answered, "Whether well or not, I do not know, but I do know that you have cut off your right hand with your left." And so it proved. In killing the man who prevented him from claiming full power, Valentinian had destroyed his only chances of retaining any power at all. Just weeks later, Petronius Maximus convinced two old army cronies of Aetius's to assassinate the emperor as he practiced archery in the Campus Martius. They stole the dead man's crown and fled with it to Petronius Maximus, who took it and declared himself emperor. Thus began a 7-year cycle of death and destruction. Petronius Maximus tried to head off the Vandals by sending the retired prefect of Gaul, a native of Gaul named Avitus, who was living peacefully on his own Gaulish estates, to negotiate an alliance with the Visigoth king at Toulouse. But Avitus had not yet returned with Visigoth allies when Gaiseric and his Vandals landed their ships on the shores of southern Italy. The news was greeted in Rome with panic and riots. Petronius Maximus, seeing the mood of the city grow increasingly ugly, tried to leave, but he was riding away from the walls when a rock thrown by a rioter struck and killed him. Rome was without an emperor and without a general. 3 days after Maximus's death, on April 22nd of 455, the Vandals arrived at the city and broke through the gates. For 14 days, the North African barbarians roved through the city, plundering and wrecking so thoroughly that their name became a new verb: to vandalize, to ruin without purpose. In fact, the plundering had a very definite purpose. Gaiseric did not intend to try to hold the city. He wanted its wealth, and the Vandals did a thorough job of stealing all the gold and silver of Rome, even tearing the gold plating off the roof of the temple of Jupiter Capitolinus. The intercession of the Pope, Leo the Great, prevented the burning of the city and the large-scale massacre of the people, but even Leo could not prevent Gaiseric from kidnapping Valentinian's widow and his 2 teenage daughters. The Vandals returned to Carthage with the 3 women and ships full of treasure. One ship, loaded with statues, sank and is still in the Mediterranean mud somewhere, but the others reached North Africa safely. Gaiseric then married his son Honoric to the older of the 2 girls, Eudocia, the same daughter Aetius had chosen for his own son, and sent the other 2 women with his compliments to Constantinople. In Constantinople, the new Eastern Roman Emperor, Marcian, welcomed Valentinian's family. But he refused to send Eastern Roman soldiers west to avenge the sack of Rome. He had sworn, more than 20 years earlier, never again to fight against the Vandals. It had been a condition of his release after he had been taken prisoner at the capture of Carthage by Gaiseric and his invading army. When the news of Petronius Maximus's death and the sack of Rome arrived in Toulouse, where the Gaulish ambassador Avitus was still negotiating with the Visigoths, the Visigoth king Theodoric II suggested that Avitus declare himself emperor. He offered his own Visigoth force as allies. Avitus accepted and marched south across the Alps, entering Rome in triumph as the 3rd emperor to rule within the year. By this point, Rome was robbed, wrecked, and hungry. Avitus found himself grappling with a city devastated by famine and plunder. There was so little food that he was forced to send the Visigothic allies away, since there was no way to feed them. First, though, he had to pay them, and since there was no money left in the treasury, he stripped all the remaining bronze off the public buildings and handed it over to them. This infuriated the people of Rome, who were in a mood to be infuriated by any offence, and Avitus's attempts to rule failed in less than a year. He had appointed as his magister militum a half-German general named Ricimer, who had fought under Aetius as a young man. While Avitus was trying to pacify Rome, Ricimer was off south, driving the remaining Vandals back from the Italian coast. This made him enormously well-liked, in inverse proportion to Avitus's plummeting popularity. In 456, when Avitus finally fled from the city of Rome in fear for his life, heading back to his estates in Gaul, Ricimer met him on the road and took him prisoner. The early historians disagree on what happened next, but it appears that Ricimer kept him under guard for some months, after which Avitus died of unknown causes. Ricimer was now the most powerful man in Rome, but he knew that his barbarian ancestry would prevent the Roman Senate from confirming his rule as emperor. So he prepared to appoint a colleague, the soldier Majorian, who now became the Western Emperor in name and Ricimer's puppet in reality. Majorian served, usefully, as Ricimer's public face, which meant that Ricimer could shift the blame for failure onto his shoulders. In 460, Majorian and the Western Roman army gathered on the coast of Hispania, thanks to the friendship of the Visigoths, with 300 ships, preparing to attack the Vandal kingdom in North Africa. Procopius writes that the ships assembled at the Pillars of Hercules, the entrance to the Mediterranean, planning to cross over the strait at that point and then to march by land from there against Carthage. Gaiseric began to prepare for a massive war. The people of Italy, expecting victory, got ready to celebrate. A sneak attack cut the invasion short. The ships, says the chronicler Hydatius, were suddenly seized from the shore by Vandals, who had been given information by traitors. Some behind-the-scene plot, either carried out with the connivance of the Visigoths or done with the help of someone in the Western Roman army, had thoroughly sabotaged the plan. Majorian began to march from Hispania back towards Italy in disgrace. In the foothills of the Apennines, Ricimer's men waylaid and beheaded him. In his place, Ricimer chose Libius Severus, who became the next emperor of the Western Roman Empire. No one seems to have recorded much of anything that Severus did. He was simply another one of Ricimer's faces, and he only remained in place for 4 years. In 465, he died in Rome, either of sickness or of poison, and for 18 months Ricimer did not bother to push for the appointment of another emperor. The idea of a legitimate Roman emperor in the West was suddenly revealed for what it was, a myth which helped the Romans pretend that a disintegrating realm, now consisting of little more than the peninsula of Italy, still had some vital connection with the glory of the past. A useful fiction which disguised the truth that to be Roman and to be barbarian were now one and the same. Finally, in 467, Ricimer roused himself to appoint a new emperor, not because he needed one, but because he found it useful in facing his current problem, the Visigoths. In 466, Theodoric II of the Visigoths had been murdered by his brother Euric, who took up the Visigothic flag and started storming around Gaul with it. He was rapidly expanding his reign over land that had once been Roman, and Ricimer needed to fight back. The Visigoths had once been a useful ally. Now they were a menace. But Ricimer did not intend to start an actual war without the figurehead of an emperor to lead it. So in 467, he proposed to the Senate that the Roman general Anthemius, who happened to be married to the daughter of the Eastern Emperor Marcian, become the new imperator. Anthemius, who was no fool, suggested that Ricimer also marry his own daughter Alypia to create an extra layer of loyalty. The marriage was celebrated late in 467, just as the poet Sidonius Apollinaris was arriving in Rome. "My arrival coincided with the marriage of the patrician Ricimer," he wrote to a friend, "to whom the hand of the emperor's daughter was being accorded in the hope of securer times for the state. Though the bride has been given away, though the bridegroom has put off his wreath, the consular his palm-broidered robe, the brideswoman her wedding gown, the distinguished senator his toga, and the plain man his cloak, yet the noise of the great gathering has not died away in the palace chambers, because the bride still delays to start for her husband's house." Apparently, Alypia was not pleased with the marriage. Ricimer was now a soldier in his 60s, 15 years older than her own father. Together, Ricimer and the new emperor Anthemius prepared for war against the Visigoths. The Visigoths had provided the Romans with soldiers to fight against the Vandals. Now the two men looked around for soldiers who could help them fight against the Visigoths. They found a new alliance in the northwestern corner of Gaul. There, a Briton named Riotimus had settled with some 12,000 men. They were tired of the ongoing battle between the British and the Angles and Saxons, and had crossed the Channel to find peace. But peace was hard to come by in the lands of the old empire. Riotimus knew that the spread of Visigothic power threatened his new home, which had become known as Brittany. He agreed to supply 12,000 men for the fight against the Visigoths, but the Visigothic king Euric did not give the reinforcements time to join up with the main body of the Roman army. "He came against the Britones with an innumerable army," Jordanes says, "and after a long fight he routed Riotimus, king of the Britones, before the Romans could join him." The fight against the Visigoths had failed almost before it began, and the Visigothic kingdom in Hispania spread still farther. Meanwhile, Roman soldiers continued fighting fruitlessly against the Vandals in North Africa. Nothing was going well, and when Anthemius got sick in 470, he decided that his ill fortune had been caused by black magic. "He punished many men involved in this crime," writes John of Antioch, even though the crime itself was unproven sorcery, and started putting men to death. Ricimer, who was in Milan, heard of the witch hunt with exasperation. He recalled 6,000 soldiers from the North African front, marched into Rome, and in 472 defeated Anthemius and put him to death. The marriage had not saved Anthemius, but Ricimer did not survive much past his father-in-law. He had barely arrived in Rome when he came down with a fever. 2 months later, Ricimer was dead. Without its puppet master, the empire stumbled even more fatally. Anthemius was followed by 4 emperors in 4 years, none of them managing to assert any kind of real power. Finally, another barbarian soldier stepped forward to take control. His name was Orestes, and he had already emerged once at a turning point of Roman history. He had been the Roman-born ambassador sent from Attila the Hun to Constantinople back in 449. After the Hun disintegration, he had returned to serve in the Western Roman army and had gained an increasing following. In 475, with the title of Roman Emperor held by the useless Julius Nepos, Orestes rallied his troops behind him, hired a collection of Germanic mercenaries from various tribes, and marched on Ravenna. Julius Nepos fled without putting up a fight. Rather than taking the throne himself, the myth that Roman emperors were not barbarians had been exposed but still lived, Orestes appointed his own 10-year-old son, Romulus, to the imperial throne. Romulus, the child of Orestes and his fully Roman wife, was less barbarian by blood than the father. The court at Ravenna was willing to accept this fiction, which kept the Roman title alive for one more year. Romulus, given the patronizing nickname Augustulus, meaning Little Augustus, by his subjects, sat on the throne for a single year, while the Western Empire fell apart around him. In 476, even the fiction failed. Orestes had promised to pay his Germanic mercenaries by giving them land in Italy to settle on. Now their leader, the general Odovaca, a German and a Christian, demanded more land for his followers. Orestes refused, and in the hot days of August, Odovaca and the mercenaries marched toward Ravenna, seeking payment and revenge. Orestes met him in battle at Placentia, in northern Italy. The Roman forces were defeated. Orestes was killed in the fighting. Odovaca went on to Ravenna unopposed, took little Romulus prisoner, and sent him to live in a castle in Campania. Castel dell'Ovo, a fortress on an island reached only by a causeway. There he spent the rest of his days in obscurity. Thus the Western Empire of the Roman race, says Jordanes, which Octavianus Augustus, the first of the Augusti, began to govern in the 709th year from the founding of the city, perished. And from this time onward, kings of the Goths held Rome and Italy. The old Western Empire, with its stubborn insistence that Romans must rule in Roman land, was no more. But the death warrant for the Western Empire had been signed by Constantine over a century before, when he had decided that Romanness alone could hold the empire together. Odovaca's rise to the throne of Italy was merely the final admission of what had already happened. The barbarians had given up on the project of becoming Roman. Italy was largely Christian. Odovaca was a Christian. He took the title King of Italy, separating himself from the old imperial past. He was a competent soldier and a decent administrator. And as far as his supporters were concerned, his blood no longer mattered. Part 3. New Powers. Chapter 21. The Ostrogoths. Between 457 and 493, the Isaurians ascend to the eastern throne, the Ostrogoths take control of Italy, and the Benedictines retreat. In 457, the Eastern Roman Emperor Marcian died at the age of 65. His wife, Pulcheria, had died 4 years earlier. The Theodosian dynasty that had ruled in Constantinople since 379 had ended. Author's note, the Theodosian dynasty ruled from 379 to 457. The Leonid dynasty, which followed, ruled from 457 to 518. As there was no blood heir available, the army had the greatest say in who would become emperor next. Their commanding general would normally have been a top candidate, but in 457, the army was commanded by a man of barbarian descent, Aspar, who belonged to a tribe known as the Alans. They had once lived east of the Black Sea, and had been driven from their own lands by the Huns decades earlier. The Eastern Empire, still calling itself Roman, clung to its old suspicion of barbarian blood. Aspar could no more become emperor of the Eastern Roman realm than the Vandal Stilicho or the Visigoth Ricimer could have become emperor in the West. Instead, Aspar chose the agreeable 50-ish steward of his household, Leo the Thracian, to be his voice piece. Leo was crowned emperor by the Patriarch of Constantinople, the first time the bishop had taken on this pope-like role in the East. But once on the throne, Leo the Thracian proved impossible to manipulate. Aspar had the loyalty of the army, so in order to reduce his general's influence, Leo made a new series of alliances with the Isaurians, a mountain people of southern Asia Minor. The Isaurians had been under Roman rule for 500 years, but they had remained warlike and free-acting, carrying on their own affairs almost independently on the slopes of the Taurus Mountains. They had the advantages of barbarians, the skill at war, the self-directed purpose, without the disadvantages. They were, thanks to the centuries that had passed since their incorporation into the empire, undisputably Roman. Leo, who had no sons, another reason why Aspar had fingered him for the job of emperor, made a match between his daughter Ariadne and the Isaurian leader Zeno. With the Isaurians behind him, he accused Aspar of treachery and in 471 executed him. 3 years later, the elderly emperor died of dysentery. His daughter's 6-year-old son, Leo II, was crowned as emperor in his place. Leo II's father, the Isaurian warrior Zeno, served as his regent. The child ruled for 10 months, rubber-stamped his father's coronation as co-emperor, and then died, leaving the Isaurian on the throne of the Eastern Roman Empire. This was a dizzying rise to power for the Isaurians, and it created temporary unrest in Constantinople. Leo the Thracian's brother-in-law managed to raise an army against Zeno and drive him out of the city. The brother-in-law, Basiliscus, then crowned himself emperor. Thanks to his policies of heavy taxation, though, Basiliscus made himself unpopular. Meanwhile, Zeno had gone home and assembled an Isaurian army of his own, which he marched back into Constantinople 18 months later. The financially strapped population greeted him with relief, and Basiliscus deserted his throne and fled to a nearby church. Zeno, standing outside the church, got Basiliscus out by promising that he would not shed the usurper's blood. When Basiliscus emerged, Zeno then shut him up in a dry cistern and let him starve to death. Firmly back in power by 476, Zeno the Isaurian watched from the east as the remnants of the Western Roman Empire spun apart. Odovaca, the Germanic general who had just removed little Romulus from the throne, was now king of Italy. He had taken Ravenna by force. Jordanus says that his initial strategy was to inspire a fear of himself among the Romans, but there was a limit to how long he could rule over the larger territory of Italy through terror. To bolster his claim to power, Odovaca sent a message to Zeno, suggesting a new strategy. He would acknowledge Zeno as overlord and emperor, and would rule Italy in submission to the Eastern Empire, if Zeno would in turn recognize him as rightful ruler of Italy. Zeno accepted the offer, and gave Odovaca the title of Patrician, not King, of Italy. It was a titular reunification. For a brief time, under Zeno the Isaurian, the empire was again won. But Odovaca, having obtained a legitimacy that made his mastery of the Romans in Italy a little easier, went on to ignore Zeno and do exactly as he pleased. In 477, he conquered Sicily, which had been in the hands of the Vandals. The great Vandal king Gaiseric had just died, and the Vandal kingdom declined in power without his leadership. He made treaties, just like an independent king, with the Visigoths, who now ruled a kingdom that stretched from the Loire all the way across Hispania, and with the Franks. By 488, Zeno was seriously worried about Odovaca's growing ambition. Zeno also had another western problem to solve. A coalition of Ostrogoths was moving from their lands in the west, eastwards, towards Constantinople. They were led by a soldier named Theodoric, son of a Gothic chief who had spent 10 years as a child in Constantinople, a hostage guaranteeing the good behaviour of his father. At 18, he had returned to his people and become their leader, which meant that he had the task of finding them more land. The Ostrogoths had too many people and not enough space. They were hungry and overcrowded. Author's note: this story is complicated by the number of Goths named Theodoric. Theodoric the Ostrogoth should not be confused with Theodoric I or Theodoric II, both of whom were kings of the Visigothic Confederation. In addition, there were actually two coalitions of Ostrogoths, each one led by a general named Theodoric. The general referred to here is the first Theodoric, Theodoric the Ostrogoth, who would become known as Theodoric the Great. He commanded Ostrogoths from Pannonia, while his distant cousin, Theodoric the Squinter, named after his unfortunate eyes, was from Thracia. The two generals were not automatic allies, since they were competing for the same scarce resources. They acted together against Zeno at least once, and Zeno had allied himself with one Theodoric against the other at various times. However, Theodoric the Squinter died around 485, after which Theodoric the Great dominated the Ostrogoths. Between 478 and 488, the Ostrogoths under Theodoric advanced steadily towards Constantinople, claiming food and territory as they went. Zeno tried to appease Theodoric with the title of Magister Militum, awarded him land in the regions of Dacia and Moesia, and even paid him a substantial amount of money when Theodoric threatened to besiege Constantinople itself in 486, but none of these solutions had pacified the Ostrogoths for long. Zeno decided to solve the two problems simultaneously. He offered to recognize Theodoric the Ostrogoth as king of Italy and give him the peninsula, as long as Theodoric would go west and get rid of Odovaca. The sources disagree about who first came up with this plan, Theodoric or Zeno. But whoever thought it up, Theodoric liked it. He headed west, marching at the head of a heterogeneous mass of adventurers, Ostrogoths, random Huns, discontented Romans, displaced members of other Germanic tribes. The Gaulish writer Ennodius, who was a child at the time, writes that a whole world followed Theodoric to Italy, perhaps as many as 100,000 people in search of a country. When they marched into northern Italy, Odovaca tried to resist. He assembled an army on the plain of Verona to block the path of the invaders, but Theodoric destroyed it with great slaughter and stormed towards Ravenna. The fight over Italy went on for 3 years. Jordanes says that Odovaca spent most of those 3 years holed up in Ravenna. He frequently harassed the army of the Goths at night, he writes, sallying forth with his men, and thus he struggled. Ravenna grew increasingly shabby and hungry. Finally, in 491, Odovaca suggested a compromise. He would sign a treaty making the two of them co-rulers of Italy if Theodoric would lift the siege. Theodoric had found the siege frustrating. Odovaca could resupply the city by sea, and Theodoric, with no fleet, couldn't stop him. He agreed to the compromise. But in 493 he ended their joint rule by killing his colleague. The contemporary account of Valencianus says that the Ostrogoth king hewed his co-ruler in two with his own hands, boasting that his suspicions were at last confirmed. Odovaca had no backbone. Unlike Odovaca, Theodoric had a spine. He was not interested in being a patrician and paying lip service to Constantinople. He was now Theodoric the Great, king of Italy, and as king he had no duty to pay the Eastern Roman emperor. One of his first acts was to declare that only the Romans who had supported him in his takeover of Italy could still claim to be Roman citizens. The rest were deprived of their rights. Roman citizenship, that once prized distinction, was now connected directly to the person of Theodoric the Great. Under Theodoric's rule, the prestige of Rome, once queen of the world, faded away. Theodoric visited Rome only once in the year 500, and never bothered to go back. The Senate still met in Rome, but the power of law lay with the king, and ultimately the Senate rubber-stamped his rule. Roman culture made inroads into Gothic practice. The Goths increasingly spoke Latin, adopted Roman names, married Roman women, and cultivated Roman estates. But while Romans held many of the civil offices in Theodoric's government, high military posts were held almost exclusively by Goths. Boys were sent to Rome to study grammar and rhetoric, but Ravenna, dominated by Goths, was the power centre of the kingdom. The conflict between the two races came sharply to the fore when Theodoric died in 526. His heir, his 10-year-old son, Athalaric, became a pawn in a struggle for power between his mother, Amalasuntha, who served as his regent, and the Ostrogoth nobles who wanted to control the kingdom from behind the throne. Amalasuntha wanted to send her son to school in Rome to receive the sort of education that Roman princes received. The Goths objected that a Roman education would make him a sissy. Procopius writes, "For letters, they said, are far removed from manliness, and the teaching of old men results for the most part in a cowardly and submissive spirit. Therefore, the man who is to show daring ought to be freed from the timidity which teachers inspire, and to take his training in arms." Apparently, Theodoric himself, careful though he was to keep the Romans and Goths in his empire on more or less equal footing, had nurtured misgivings of his own over the value of a Roman education. The Goths claimed that he would never allow any of the Goths to send their children to school. For he used to say that if the fear of the strap once came over them, they would never have the resolution to despise sword or spear. Clearly, a literary education in Rome was not the high road to power and influence it had once been, and the lifestyle of young men studying in the once capital grew increasingly dissolute and aimless. One of the young men sent to school in Rome was Benedict of Nursia, son of a Roman nobleman. Like Augustine, he dabbled in the less respectable pastimes available to him, but finally he grew exasperated with the noise and licentiousness of the city, gave up his studies, which weren't providing him with any advantage in any case, and left. According to Gregory the Great, who provides us with the only account of Benedict's life, he ended up in a cave in the Apennines, about 40 miles east of Rome, near the modern town of Subiaco. At some point he had heard the teachings of Christianity and had been converted. Now he devoted himself to the lifestyle of a pious hermit, seeking to understand the grace of God in solitude. News of the hermit in the wilderness spread, and several years later monks in a nearby monastery asked him to come and take charge of their community, since their abbot had just died. Benedict agreed. His chaotic years in Rome and his solitary meditation had given him a vision for community life that was regulated, quiet, and productive. Having now taken upon him the charge of the abbey, says Gregory the Great, he took order that regular life should be observed, so that none of them could, as before they used, through unlawful acts, decline from the path of holy conversation, either on the one side or on the other. The monks, unused to such strict supervision, decided to poison his wine. But Benedict got wind of the plan and went back to his cave. There he taught the shepherds who came to see him, converting a number of them to the monastic lifestyle. Around 529, he led them up a mountain near the town of Cassino. On the mountaintop, an old temple of Apollo had been slowly decaying into ruins. Benedict and his monks burned it, and in its place began to build a monastery of their own. In this monastery, Monte Cassino, Benedict developed the rules by which his community would live, the rule of St. Benedict. The rule was the lex of a kingdom removed from the political struggles, a conscious attempt to bring Christian practice back to the realm where the Indian and Chinese monks dwelt. "We desire to dwell in the tabernacle of God's kingdom," Benedict wrote, "and if we fulfill the duties of tenants, we shall be heirs of the kingdom of heaven." He listed those duties: to relieve the poor, clothe the naked, visit the sick, bury the dead, to prefer nothing to the love of Christ. In daily life, silence was preferable to speech, since words so often led into sin. The monks, rising regularly during the night to sing psalms, were to sleep clothed, so that they would always be prepared for worship and service. The abbot was to consult the monks over decisions that affected the whole community, but in the end, his decisions were final. The vice of personal ownership was to be cut out in the monastery by the very root, so that monks were to own nothing, not even books or writing materials. Each monk was to spend a prescribed number of hours per day in manual labor. Any monk who persisted in breaking the rule was to be barred from eating with the community or taking part in worship until he repented. Gregory the Great reports that the spirit of prophecy allowed Benedict to know when the monks were breaking the rule, even when they were away from the monastery. When they returned, he would tell them their faults. They repented and would not any more in his absence presume to do any such thing, seeing they now perceive that he was present with them in spirit. As the first abbot of Monte Cassino, Benedict was the ruler that Italy lacked, devoted to a calling higher than his own ambitions, offering a law that was the same for all and was enforced with absolute justice and regularity, providing a clear and straightforward path into happiness. The Benedictine way of life provided the monks with unity, with an identity as members of a community they themselves constituted, and it was, above all, orderly. "You who hasten to the heavenly country," the rule concluded, "perform with Christ's aid this rule, which is written down as the least of beginnings, and then, at length, under God's protection, you will come to the greater things that we have mentioned, to the heights of learning and virtue." Learning and virtue had once been prized in Rome, but now they led nowhere. Only in the Benedictine monastery did the exercise of the mind and the discipline of the spirit yield great reward. Chapter 22. Byzantium. Between 471 and 518, the Persians object to social reform, Slavs and Bulgars appear, and the Blues and Greens fight in Constantinople. Persia was suffering, and in 471 the suffering was compounded when the Persian king led the empire into war. Yazdegerd II had died in 457, and his oldest son, Peroz, had taken the throne after a brief struggle with his brothers. Peroz's 27-year reign was a difficult one. Persia suffered from a severe famine and, according to the eyewitness account attributed to the Eastern monk Joshua the Stylite, locusts, earthquake, plague, and a solar eclipse. On the heels of the famine came war with the Hephthalites, the same peoples who had straggled down across the Kush Mountains to cause trouble for the Gupta kings of India. They had settled into a kingdom on the eastern side of the Persian Empire, but Peroz quarreled repeatedly with the Hephthalite king over the boundary between their lands. In 471 he finally marched an army into Hephthalite territory. The Hephthalites retreated in front of them, craftily, and then circled around behind and trapped the Persian army. Peroz was forced to surrender, swear an oath that he would never attack again, and retreat. He also agreed to pay the Hephthalites an enormous tribute, so large that it took him 2 years to raise it from his people. Meanwhile, his oldest son, Kavad, spent 2 years at the Hephthalite court as a hostage, a guarantee that the money, 30 mules loaded with silver according to Joshua the Stylite, would eventually be handed over. Peroz finally managed to tax the tribute out of his people, and Kavad returned home. But the defeat simmered in the mind of the Persian king until he could no longer bear it. In 484 he assembled an even greater army and invaded Hephthalite land once more. Again he was tricked. Procopius says that the Hephthalites dug a pit and covered it over with reeds sprinkled with earth, and then withdrew beyond it to set up their battle line. Al-Tabari adds that the Hephthalite king stuck the treaty that Peroz had signed, promising not to invade Hephthalite territory again, on the tip of his spear. The Persians, thundering forward into battle, fell into the pit, horses, lances, and all. Peroz himself was killed, and the whole Persian army with him. It was a shattering defeat, perhaps the worst in the history of Sassanid Persia. The Hephthalites, who up until this point had remained on the eastern side of the Oxus River, now took control of Khorasan, the Persian province on the western side, and the Persians became subject and tributary to the Hephthalites. Peroz's body, crushed by the twisted mass of men and horses in the battlefield trench, was never recovered. Back at the Persian capital, Ctesiphon, Peroz's son and heir, Kavad, was driven out by Peroz's brother, Balash. The brief civil war that followed was complicated by the fact that the Persian treasury was empty. Balash sent ambassadors to Constantinople to ask for Roman help, but none appeared. Unable to fight on multiple fronts, he agreed to put an end to the ongoing problem of Armenia by signing a treaty that gave the Armenians independence to run their own affairs. Author's note: this is known as the Neversec Treaty. As a result of the treaty, Armenia was able to preserve itself as a nation. Meanwhile, Kavad, like Itzias before him, took advantage of the friendships he had formed as a hostage and went to the Hephthalites for help. It took him several years to talk their king into assisting him, but in 488 he was finally able to claim the Persian throne as his own, which introduced a brand new complication into Persian attempts to recover from the ill-advised wars with the Hephthalites. Rather than being a follower of the Orthodox Zoroastrian religion, Kavad I was a disciple of a heretical cult led by a Persian prophet named Mazdak. Zoroastrianism, like Christianity, believed that good would ultimately triumph. The Christian savior would return to earth to destroy evil and make all things right, while the Zoroastrian god Ahura Mazda would wipe out his evil competitor, Ahriman, renew the earth, and raise the dead so that they could walk upon it in perfect bliss. But Mazdak, like the Christian Gnostics, taught that the ultimate power in the universe was a distant and uninvolved deity, and that two lesser but equal divine powers, good and evil, struggled over the universe. Men had to align themselves with the good power and reject the evil, choosing light over darkness. Different Gnostic religions suggested various ways in which that might be done. Mazdak believed that the primary way of finding the light was to get rid of human suffering by making all men, and to some degree women, equal. He preached that men should share their resources equally, no one owning private property to the detriment of others, that competition should be replaced by equality, strife by brother love. Unlike Christian Gnosticism, Mazdakism worked itself out as social justice. Kavad I began to reform his country in line with Mazdak's ideas. The laws he passed puzzled his contemporaries so deeply that some interpretation is necessary if we are to figure out exactly what he intended. Al-Tabari says that he intended to take from the rich for the poor, and give to those possessing little out of the share of those possessing much, while Procopius writes that Kavad wanted the Persians to have communal intercourse with their women. It is highly improbable that Kavad I was trying to institute full communism in Persia, but it is very likely indeed that he was attempting to redistribute some of the wealth held by the powerful Persian nobles. This would have reduced their power and influence, which could have only helped Kavad I, and that he lifted some of the oppressive restrictions that forced women to marry men of their own class and allowed them to be shut up in the harems of wealthy noblemen. The Persian nobles naturally resented the curtailment of their privileges, and Kavad's social reforms ended in 496 when the aristocrats of his court removed him by force and put his brother Zamasp on the throne of Persia. Zamasp refused to murder anyone who shared his bloodline, and so Kavad was hauled away to southern Persia, to a prison called the Fortress of Oblivion. "For if anyone is cast into it," Procopius writes, "the law permits no mention of him to be made thereafter, but death is the penalty for the man who speaks his name." While Zamasp rolled back his brother's reforms, Kavad languished in the Fortress of Oblivion for 2 years. Finally, he managed to make his escape. Al-Tabari says that Kavad's sister sprang him out of prison by getting visiting privileges through sleeping with the fortress's warden, rolling Kavad up in a carpet and having the carpet carried out. Procopius says that the woman who slept with the warden was Kavad's wife, and that once she had earned the privilege of seeing her husband, the two switched clothes, and Kavad made his escape under cover of a woman's robe. Either way, Kavad made his way to the land of the Hephthalites, where he once again pled for help in regaining his throne. The Hephthalite king not only agreed, but also gave Kavad his own daughter as a wife to seal the bargain. Kavad marched back to Ctesiphon at the head of a Hephthalite army. The Persian soldiers fled as soon as they saw the size of their opponents, and Kavad broke into the palace, blinded his brother with a hot iron needle, and imprisoned him. His second possession of the throne lasted over 30 years, but there was no more flirting with communism and no further attempts to level the Persian playing field through social justice legislation. He could rule only with the support of the Persian noblemen and with the help of the soldiers they supplied. and this placed a limit on his power. What he could do, however, was fight the Eastern Romans, and in 502 he declared war on the Roman Emperor Anastasius. Zeno the Isaurian died without a son in 491. A month after his death, his widow married Anastasius, a minor but devout court official who became the new emperor of the Eastern Romans. He was undistinguished both in peace and in war, and his most notable feature was a mismatched pair of eyes, one black and one blue, which earned him the nickname the Two-Eyed. His attempts to fight off Kavad were inept and futile. The Persians sacked the Roman half of Armenia and laid siege to the border city of Amida, a siege that went on for 80 days, while Kavad's Arab allies, under the Arab king Naaman of Al-Hira, ranged farther south and sacked the territory around Haran and Edessa. Finally, the Persians took Amida. Procopius says that they broke in when the Christian monks, who had been given the defense of one of the towers, had a religious festival, ate and drank too much, and went to sleep. Once inside the city, they massacred the population, 80,000 people, according to Joshua the Stylite, who adds that they piled the bodies in two huge heaps outside the city so that the smell of decomposing corpses wouldn't choke the Persian occupiers. The conquest of Amida would probably have been followed by many more Persian triumphs had Kavad not found himself dealing with another Hephthalite invasion on his other border. His alliance by marriage had not produced a permanent peace with the eastern enemies. He found himself fighting on two fronts, and although the Persian army continued to devastate the land on the eastern Roman border, by 506 the two empires were ready to negotiate a treaty. The war was over. Not much had been accomplished, except that the Romans had lost a little more than they had gained. The treaty gave Amida back to the Romans, but the Persians remained in control of their most important conquest. Just before peace negotiations opened, they had taken control of the narrow path through the Caucasus Mountains, known to the ancients as the Caspian Gates. The king who controlled the gates had power to open or close the south to invaders from the north. The Persian invasion was only one of Anastasius's problems. New peoples had appeared on the western border.